Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mark Alden, former president of the Atlanta Press Club. Thank you for joining us for today's Newsmaker Luncheon. Our special guest will be Dr. Julie Gerberding, chief of the Centers for Disease Control. She is on her way. We want to thank our presenting sponsor, Solvay Pharmaceuticals, and also our program sponsor, Perkins & Will. Dr. Gerberding has agreed to take questions from the audience after she speaks. You should find some little cards on your table. If you'll write those questions on those blank cards, we'll collect them toward the end of lunch. The Atlanta Press Club is one of the largest and most active press clubs in the world. By becoming a member, you can enjoy the benefits from a network of press clubs around the country, including the National Press Club in New York, the National Press Club in Washington and the International Press Club in New York. You can also be the first to hear about programs like this one, which actually sold out in 6 days, so it'll sort of put you to the front of the line. We encourage you to join. Please see the flyer on your seat for more information on the Atlanta Press Club and on our upcoming events. Right now, I would like you to please remember to silence your cell phones or your pagers, and please enjoy your lunch. I'll be back in a few minutes to introduce our special guest. Okay, as you finish up your lunch, we will get our program started, and we'll also come around and collect some of those question cards that we left on your table. Dr. Julie Gerberding has been director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, better known as the CDC, since July 2002. For 3 years in a row, she has been named to Forbes' Most Powerful Women list. She is a native of South Dakota, who earned her medical degree as well as degrees in chemistry and biology at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. She began her medical career in San Francisco during the early days of the HIV/AIDS outbreak. That experience of investigating a mysterious medical epidemic in an environment of intense public scrutiny and near panic has served her well in her current position. As the leader on the front lines of public health, Dr. Gerberding has dealt with the anthrax letter attacks, the SARS epidemic, the devastating Indian Ocean tsunami, Hurricane Katrina, and preparations for a possible bird flu pandemic. The CDC has also been the subject of headlines and controversy after a comprehensive reorganization of the agency launched in 2003. In fact, she is the focus of a fascinating article in the October edition of Business to Business magazine entitled "Julie Gerberding Fights Back." Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Julie Gerberding.
So good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me. It doesn't bother me at all if you eat while I talk. I'm used to it, so please enjoy your lunch while we're having a conversation. What I would like to first do is thank you, and thank Lori and Solvay for helping to sponsor this, and certainly thank the Press Club for this wonderful series. I got a chance to hear a little bit about it. I understand that Clarence Thompson was here last week, and that's a pretty tough act to follow, although I wouldn't mind being in a panel discussion with Clarence. I really want to try to keep my comments relatively brief, but I wanted to start with a little bit of a frame, because you've mentioned some of the challenges that CDC has faced in the last 5 years. But we also look ahead to the challenges that we expect we'll be dealing with in the future. So I need to describe them in a little bit of detail because I think they have a bearing on what I think is an overarching theme that we all need to be looking at, and that is the whole concept of health system transformation. So let me start with how we see the world. The first thing we see in the world is some really big problems. We see a big problem with global poverty. And I just traveled for several weeks in Africa, in developing countries, seeing firsthand what exactly the consequences of that global poverty really are and how it intersects with the second big challenge we have, which are the emerging infectious diseases that are seemingly coming at us more frequently, more broadly, and moving more rapidly from one corner of the world to another. We're not just talking about something like SARS, which literally was in a hotel room in Hong Kong one day and 48 hours later had disseminated through 12 travelers all over the world. But we're talking about things like chikungunya virus. How many people know what that is? So 250,000 people were infected with that virus last year in the Indian Ocean region.
and it's moving its way west. It most recently has appeared in Italy. And guess what? It's transmitted by exactly the same mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus. So I think we will not be surprised when that infection finally makes its way into our hemisphere. So poverty, emerging infectious diseases, and then, of course, the big problem that's been on my mind the last 24 hours, climate change. Climate change is a really important public health issue, and we see it as a force not only for immediate health consequences for things like heat stroke or severe weather. And on a day like yesterday when I'm sitting in the Congress testifying and I'm watching the conversation about the 14 fires in Southern California, the worst ever, and I'm a Californian and I know what fires in California are like, the flooding in New Orleans, and of course the tremendous drought that we're experiencing here in the Southeast, it's hard not to appreciate that not only is weather extreme, but in each one of those cases, there are profound, urgent, and sometimes traumatic effects on human health. But there's also the more longitudinal issue of climate change, and that has to do with the way it affects food security and poverty, the way it affects water security and poverty, and the way those two issues also intersect in the domain of emerging infectious diseases and things like how vector-borne diseases are transmitted, where mosquitoes are, how reservoirs like rats and rodents in South Mexico or something like bats in the caves in Uganda influence how these diseases move from prison to prison. By the way, I was just in Uganda about a month ago now, in western Uganda with the CDC field team there that was trapping bats in a cave after some miners in the cave acquired Marburg virus, a very fatal hemorrhagic fever. And just in a cave with 500,000 bats dressed in BSL-4 safety equipment, and thinking to myself, boy, this is really a remarkable experience for a CDC director to have. Well, I was not home very long when we got word that one of the men who were in the cave with us when we were trapping was just diagnosed with Marburg infection. Now, I didn't bring that virus home because we were very safe and very careful, but it just points out that the world is so incredibly small that something that is in a remote cave in Uganda really could make its way out of that environment into an urban environment and then travel with travelers. So, big problems that I'm talking about are things that are very much on CDC's plate. We think of these as the urgent threats that we face. But when you think about climate change, it brings in a second dimension of the challenges that we face as an agency, and that's the incredibly high expectations that people have of us. We are a really great agency, in my opinion, but we're not perfect. And we are operating in an environment where people really expect perfection. Yesterday, I was absolutely happy with my testimony in Congress because I think it was really important to put on the plate of the Senate, particularly the Environmental Public Works Committee, how important the CDC views the issue of the health consequences of climate change. And I've read the previous hearings and the reports that have already appeared in front of this committee, and they've touched on all kinds of dimensions of climate change except health. So we finally had the chance to go and say what we thought was important. And I feel very confident that I had a completely honest conversation. I was candid. I told the Senate what I thought. I listened to both sides. I presented to the best of our ability right now what we know about the science, what we're concerned about going into the future, and some of the things that CDC is going to need to concentrate on to try to do our part to contribute to the solution. And I expected the press to write a lot of stories about the effects of climate change on human health and what CDC was doing about it. But instead, I had to read that somebody edited my testimony. I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. People probably in business and maybe in the press don't really understand how written testimony occurs. And there is something called the OMB. It's been around since, I don't know if it was there when Abraham Lincoln was president, but if it was present, I'm sure that they would do the same thing they do now, which is try to coordinate the testimony from the administration and try to make sure that enthusiastic program directors are not trying to advocate for more money coming to their agency. So they do look it over. But that's only the tip of the iceberg of the clearance process. we clear things inside of CDC. In this case, there were several centers who have scientific knowledge about climate change. They needed to correct this for accuracy. Then we go to the department. There's the National Institutes of Health. Sometimes other departmental agencies, they all read it. They edit it. Then it goes to the OMB. They edit it for coordination and budget. Then it goes probably to the EPA and NOAA and a bunch of other federal agencies. And we're not just talking about one person in each of these agencies. We're talking about gaggles of people. And what we get back is a big stack of comments and a bunch of recommendations for how to revise the testimony. Now, the first time I testified in Congress 5 years ago, I paid attention to this. I struggled with every word, every edit. I put my time and energy into this written testimony. After the second time, I said, please fix this. The third time, I said, you know what, less is best. Let's try to use the most concise written testimony that we can, because what I had learned was nobody reads it. And in fact, what happens is it's what you say. It's your oral testimony and how you answer and ask questions in Congress. And so for the last 5 years, if anyone's ever seen them here, Insomniac, and you watch C-SPAN, you will notice that I don't read my testimony. I prepare every word of it myself. In 5 years, no one's ever put a word in or taken a word out of what I've said in that regard except CDC scientists. And I stand by it. Every leader has a line in the sand that they have to stand by, and that's my line. I don't let people put words in my mouth, and I stand for science. So I gave my testimony yesterday. I spoke truth to Congress, and I have to read about all this other stuff today. So it's very disappointing, but it's happening in the context of this milieu that we're all working in, where anybody can make news, anybody can ask or request for information. The credentialing of the quality of that information is probably not optimal in all respects. And we as an agency have to be held to a higher standard, even than business, because we're accountable to people who pay our bills. We're accountable to the citizens of this country. And they need to know that they can understand what we're doing and that we're accountable for it. And when we make a mistake, we do have to own it and fix it. And agencies aren't perfect. But at the same time, we also need to be able to correct misinformation when we see it and set the record straight when we need to. So I do feel that we've got big problems, but we've also got this high expectation in an environment where time is very, very important. So we've got a lot of pressure on ourselves to do things well. And for everyone in government, we're trying to do all of this with resources that are stable at best, except in some high-profile areas that get the attention of the decision-makers. And we have to be more and more parsimonious and innovative in how we use those resources. So that's big problems, high expectations, time matters, and resource competition. That's cheaper, better, faster. And that is not a good formula, but it does drive innovation. So that is really the world in which CDC is operating right now, as any other probably business organization or even media enterprises. I think we're all facing the same set of challenges, and it does require some organizational innovation. But what I would like to focus on from a health perspective is what I think a lane of this that we all have in common, and that's the lane of health system innovation and transformation. Now, all political candidates these days, whether they're at the local, state, or federal level, are talking about healthcare transformation. They recognize that we're on a trajectory that's not sustainable, because we can't afford the health benefits that employees are being paid. And the solutions to it aren't a very long list right now. And we recognize that, and we agree that we need access for people who are uninsured, and we need more affordable benefits packages for employees, and businesses have a strong stake in this. But I'm going to ask you to think about this a little bit different way. So, you know, I have a purse here with me, and I don't have taxpayers' dollars in it, but I do have some monopoly money, okay? So I've got a lot of money here. This is something I'm going to put up here. I'm going to pass it over to you. Hang on to it, and I want everyone to think about, you know, their wad of money for health, because everybody has to make an investment in health. You do it, whether you do it indirectly through your employee benefits or your co-pays or what you buy in the drugstore over the counter or whatever snake oil you buy on the internet. Everybody is spending something on health, and everybody in the family probably cares very deeply about the health of their family, their children, their spouse, their parents, and hopefully themselves. But in America, we've gotten by for a long time without really thinking about what's the best value. What's the best way to spend that money to get the best possible health for ourselves and our families? And at CDC, we're beginning to explore this in a different way than we have before. We've said for a long time that prevention, it's prevention that we need to focus on. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure or a dollar of cure. And we still believe that. But we're backing off from the conversation about the health system right now and taking that to a completely different level. If you look at our health system, you would recognize that, first of all, we don't have one. Does anybody here work for a bank? No, probably you all have an ATM card, right? So you go to the bank, you put your ATM card, you get money out. I go to Kazakhstan, I put my card in, I get money out. I go to China, I put my card in, I get money out. Doesn't matter where I am in the world, I can take the card, stick it in a slot, and I get money out. But God forbid I should need medical attention in Kazakhstan or in some place other than my primary care provider in Atlanta, because there would be no system to support that transaction. It's completely discombobulated. So that's one aspect of the problem that we're facing. We don't really have a health system. We have a health sector. Secretary Leavitt, my boss, talks about this frequently, that we need to create a health system, and there's some ways to go about doing that, because what we have right now in the healthcare delivery sector is an environment that can create absolute miracles. You know, my family has certainly benefited from cancer treatments and a number of other really amazing biotechnical interventions. But a lot of people don't have access to that. The number seems to be growing, according to a report released from CDC today. But also, that system doesn't really measure results. You can't go to very many systems and really find out which healthcare organizations create the healthiest people or end up with the best possible outcome. And you certainly can't relate that to the money going in. How much are we investing to end up with this kind of outcome? The investments are disguised. Try to find out what something costs. You can tell it depends on what your insurance is. Depends on which facility you go to. There's no association between cost, charge, and the value of the services that you get. In our healthcare system, we also don't reward people who achieve the best results. We award the people who do the most procedures, or we reward the people who get the biggest purchasing agreement from the biggest employers. But we don't actually pay on the basis of who gives us the best help for the best investment that we make. And as I've already said, we certainly don't have the information systems in our healthcare system to be able to allow us to have the kind of information that not just doctors need, but that citizens need when they're making choices about where they want to receive their help. So we have to look at that as a pretty troubling system right now. And I don't think just improving access is going to change the fact that we are investing most of any developed country in health, and we're number 41st on the list of health status in our country. So we are not getting value out of this system that we are paying so dearly for. Now let's talk about the other relevant part of this, and that's the public health system. I'll bet you, if I passed out a piece of paper here, that you would not be able to give me a definition of public health, because many people at CDC can't even give a good definition of public health. It's sort of a nebulous thing that goes on in the background of the community, and you don't know you have it until you need it or until it fails you. But you do have a public health system, and in this community, you are blessed with very good public health departments compared to most of the United States. And in this state, we have had a very good public health system. But that system, although it too can perform miracles, is incredibly under-resourced. It does not measure itself well. We don't know exactly what we're spending to support the health of people in the community or to keep our water safe or our restaurants open and our food safety high or our disease detection capability or preparedness as good as it should be. We don't really understand as citizens what that investment is. And we certainly don't have information systems that put that money in people's hands or reward the people who do it the best. So what we've begun to think about at CDC is, how can we take this public health system, which is best at protecting people's health, by keeping safe and healthy people that way, or helping those who are at risk to change their risk behaviors or learn new tools or new opportunities to protect their health. How can we take that public health system with its upstream emphasis and mirror it to the healthcare delivery system, which is all about disease care? You know, we spend 97% of our dollars on disease treatment, and we spend less than 3% on health protection. Well, in that pile of money there, where do you want to spend your money? Would you rather protect health by creating a modest investment in it if you knew that you were going to achieve that kind of value down the road? Or do you want to keep dishing it out to insure you against the requirement for catastrophic care should you ever need it? I think we in public health have always known that the best value is upstream. The best value is in protecting health through prevention, through health promotion, and through preparedness. But finally, some other people are beginning to figure that out, and that's why it's so much fun for me to be talking here today, because I think the business community has figured it out. The documentation now of the return on investment in wellness programs in the workplace, not only in terms of reduced health benefit costs, but also in terms of productivity, absenteeism, and other markers of a healthy, engaged workforce are dramatic. PricewaterhouseCoopers has done an extraordinarily in-depth analysis of this for the World Economic Forum, and it's unequivocal that investing in health protection is good business. It's not just nice or good corporate social responsibility. It's really good for business. And more businesses are able to make that transition to they see health not as a cost that they pay out in benefits, but health as an investment that allows them to recruit and retain and evolve and benefit from a wonderful employee workforce. So business is beginning to see this value. We are struggling now with smaller businesses that don't necessarily have the upfront capability to do the same thing, and there have got to be some solutions that support this at their level. But there's somebody else who's getting this, and I think it's kind of a bittersweet perspective, because I think mom is starting to get it. Because mom's starting to have to spend more of that health investment on things that the family isn't used to having to pay money out of pocket for. They're having to pay more co-pays on their insurance. They're having to pay for services and benefits that used to be covered benefits. And they're paying more for drugs and more for over-the-counter treatments and so forth. So the family budget is beginning to feel the impact of the economic cost of paying for disease care in a much more palpable way than it has for most of middle-class America in the past. And that's a very empowering dimension of this issue, because moms and dads, but moms who make 84% of all health decisions in this country, are very smart. And they know that they want to get the best health that they can for their kids and for their families, and they want to know then what is the best way for me to spend my money to do that. And they're in it for the long run, because they're not just worried about today, they're worried about tomorrow and the future of their children's health as they mature and move through their life stages. So for us at CDC, we are in a very interesting moment in time, because we finally have a multi-sector dimension to our confidence that investing in health protection is the smart thing to do, smart for families, smart for business, smart for government, and certainly smart for the broad health sector. But if you listen to candidates, and I'm not just talking about federal, this is at almost every level, they're not really talking about health. They're talking about cost, and they're talking about access. So my challenge to you as leaders of this community and as leaders communicators of this community is pay attention to what the leaders are saying. Listen. Determine if they're talking about a healthcare system or a health system. Are they talking about cost and access? Or are they talking about value and healthness? Are they dealing with diseases and clinical prevention services that go on in the doctor's office? Are they talking about how our communities can be leaner, greener, and cleaner, if you will, in this environment of sustainability?
these are the kinds of things that we need to open up for public debate. And I think a lot of people who have been so focused on trying to transform our health system have missed the boat and haven't recognized that there's a whole other conversation about healthcare reformation that needs to occur at a very front and center grassroots citizen level. Now, CDC is not going to change the world in this regard, but we have banded together with our colleagues in the state health offices and local health offices to develop our own vision of what we think should happen as this debate in our country moves forward. And we are certainly going to begin the process of convening. I think you'll be seeing some lectures that will be occurring with CDC and Emory that are focusing on opportunities to bring these perspectives to the citizen level. I will be trying to make this point every time I have a platform, if I don't have to talk about editing my testimony. And in a very fundamental sense, I think we have a real tipping point here where citizens can really, I think, begin to appreciate that they need a health system that's an incredible value to them and their communities, and that there is an evidence base to support it, and that what we're lacking is just kind of a leadership commitment and a grassroots requirement that we do it well. My final thought here is kind of a performance measure. What would be the best performance measure of success in this regard? I think it would be a community where when people run for office, the taxpayers in the community are asking them about the health statistics of their community, and they care about that just as much as they care about the educational status of the children in the community, or the potholes in the street, or the water supply. That we need to get health on the map that helps us determine who's committed, what's their track record, who's really investing in healthness in our world, and give that person your vote. So I'll end there, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Dr. Gerberding, I have a number of questions here, and we'll try to get in as many as we can.
Okay, I'll try to give short answers, although I've learned that sometimes you should try to give long answers, so you have to answer fewer questions.
First question is I'm sure this is pertaining to your testimony to Congress about climate change and human health. Is your accurate original testimony to Congress available for the public to read online, and if so, what is the address, or how can they find it?
Well, there's probably about 40 versions of the testimony, but I think the version before the largest edits were in place is posted, or is soon to be posted. I don't know, Tom, I know we're trying to recover all the versions and get them up and out, so they will be available online for sure. I think what you'll see when you look at that what was taken out was not some controversial, you know, question mark as whether it's climate change and health consequences, but rather a lot of program description at CDC and a lot of detail about some of the diseases that we basically summarized in a chart that I presented to the Congress in my slide set. So this was not an issue of trying to cover up that there's some relationship between climate change and health, but rather a process of clearing testimony that just ended up with a less is best approach. And I don't have any problem with that process. I think is not something that should really be occupying anyone's attention, other than the poor writer editors who have to deal with it.
How is illegal immigration affecting the U.S. in terms of disease, and are children being asked to get more immunizations?
I think that's two completely separate questions, if I'm not mistaken. You're not talking about immunization. I don't know if that's the question, but I'm going to answer this as if it was two separate questions. In terms of immigration, illegal or legal immigration, certainly this is a melting pot. And I think the concern about people who are not documented is that they don't have access to the kinds of basic preventive services or the emergency services that would help them be healthier, and also in cases of infectious disease, have their diseases diagnosed and treated effectively. So particularly in urban areas, I'm told by health departments and by those who have to pay for this kind of care that certainly there is an impact. And unfortunately, because it often pushes the point of care to a later stage of illness, it ends up being more expensive and less helpful to the person. In terms of immunizations, yes, we hope there are more vaccinations for kids. That's the point. And we recognize that there are a lot of shots, and we're trying to encourage the supply chain to consolidate these shots into fewer injections and make that affordable for more people. But a concern about exposure to too many vaccines is
scientifically misplaced. We are exposed to antigens that vaccinate us all the time. Every time we eat a new food or every time we come in contact with someone who's got a cold or a new bacteria that we haven't seen before, our bodies are designed to recognize antigens and to mount immune responses to them. What we do with childhood immunizations is just simply present that immunization to a child in a deliberate manner so we're sure they have the immunity to that one, and it isn't a matter of chance. And I hope we find more because we still have a lot of things that we need to protect our kids against. We also have a lot of things we need to protect our adults against, like HIV infection and hepatitis C and a few others. So vaccines are extremely important for health protection.
Can you talk about the health concerns linked to the drought here in the South?
The health concerns of drought, per se, in the short term are sometimes linked to the heat that often accompanies drought, and we haven't had extreme heat, at least to have a measurable impact on health. But if you recall in 2003 in Europe, in five countries, where there was a lack of rain and extremely high temperatures, the highest reported temperatures, there were somewhere between 22 and 44,000 deaths in those five countries related to heat injury and the cardiovascular complications. So drought plus heat is clearly an acute stressor. But I think for us in Georgia right now, the issue of water security is one that is likely to have somewhat intangible results. And one of the challenges we have at CDC and in health departments is how do we create the systems that alert us when there is a health issue at stake? We've been lucky, I guess, in the sense that we haven't had to curtail indoor water use. So presumably our hygiene has not been affected, but certainly in environments of water restriction, it's more difficult to keep things clean, to keep your own hygiene optimized and so forth. So that is certainly a potential complication that would lead to the earliest infectious disease consequences. The other consequences, sometimes climate change brings good things. If you killed all the mosquitoes, then you would have less chance of mosquito-borne illnesses being transmitted. So there are, in a region-to-region basis, some things may improve, some things may get better or worse. In some parts of the world, climate change may bring more water where people really need it. In other parts, too much water, and in some parts, not enough water. In one of the villages I visited in Kenya, where the village is dependent on glacier melt from the Kilimanjaro and the volcanoes that have snowpacks, and as those snowpacks shrink, those villages are in imminent danger of losing their water supply for a significant part of the year, and I think that would be a case where the drought and health effects would be very conspicuous and devastating.
How do we make hospitals, doctors, and the healthcare industry accountable so that patients can get access to the information that they need?
Well, that really is the big picture of what we think needs to happen. We like to talk about this as value-based healthcare, and what that means is that the information is measured and that the costs are known to the people who are paying, and that we create incentives for the places who do it right or else create sticks for the people who don't, and that that is linked together with an exchangeable information system. I have a bias, and I think Dr. Perkins here, who's the Chief Strategy Officer at CDC, agrees with me. Our bias is that probably a real transformational aspect of that information will be the ability to have your own health record. So the day that I have my health record and I can access it, even if it's all over the healthcare system, but by going into an exchange database, I can pull in my health information, just like you can go into Quicken and look at your banking information or your tax information, you can see your health record. That's a day where consumers will be truly empowered to make the kinds of decisions that we think people want to be able to make about their health services. And we're not that far away from there. It's technically feasible. It's just a matter of the system adapting and citizens recognizing and creating a market for that kind of support. But I will say a couple things about MRSA in that regard, because this is a case in point, a beautiful case in point. Methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is a dreadful pathogen. I studied it as a scientist before I came to CDC in the laboratory where I did my training. I'm very familiar with this bacteria. I don't like it at all. And now what do I see here at CDC? That it's everywhere. And it's everywhere in hospitals, and it's spreading in the community, and sometimes it causes some very serious complications because it's learning some new tricks. But in a healthcare environment, if we were to actually measure in a standardized way the facility's Staph aureus infection rate and make that information known so that people could see what the quality of the healthcare infection prevention program is there, I think there would be a stronger incentive to do something about it. And I think if we change the way Medicare pays for reimbursement to say, guess what, we're not paying for infections that complicate care if those infections are preventable with the evidence that we have today, it would change overnight. And in fact, that is exactly what CMS is going to do with this value-based health reimbursement proposal, is to say, you know, we want to give a fair price for the care that is needed, but why should we subsidize complications? Actually, a hospital gets a lot more money if you get a complication. Well, that's perverse. That's not a proper alignment with something that rewards the best possible outcome. So I think MRSA is a great test case for putting some of these principles into practice, and we're pretty eager to have a chance to contribute to that effort at CDC.
And our final question that we'll have time for today, how can the U.S. hope to effectively identify and stop the spread of a pandemic when millions of Americans, including school kids, don't even have health care?
The very hard question, and that's one of the reasons why you have a public health department, because they have that challenge and they have the responsibility for figuring that out. One of the things that we accept is that the first cases of any new infectious disease are going to be difficult to detect. But by putting point-of-care rapid diagnostics into the clinical environment, those people who are sick enough to seek attention are likely to be diagnosed pretty early in the equation. And so our strategy right now is, of course, to try to improve access, but at the same time alert citizens that if they have flu-like illness, and they have symptoms that would suggest they could benefit from antiviral treatment or may have influenza, that they should consult with a clinician and make sure they don't need treatment, but also that determine at the community level whether or not there's an indication for a flu test so that you would have a better idea of what's going on in the community. We're also taking advantage of electronic systems. We have something called BioSense, which is a very rudimentary tool right now, but it links in information from emergency rooms right now in a few hundred hospitals around the state in almost real time, so that we can see visits for influenza-like illness. And this is the first year we're actually monitoring this in parallel with our traditional, somewhat slower systems. And we're seeing that this electronic ability to watch community increases in people coming in for care related to things that could be influenza is a good marker of what might be happening in the community. So, you know, flu preparedness is really important to CDC. I know it's not in the news the way I think it should be, but pandemic preparedness is still one of the very top priorities at CDC. In fact, I spent every Wednesday morning, including this morning, as General Taylor knows, I spent this morning with the flu team, the flu scientists, going goal by goal, activity by activity, assessing our progress. We are exercising regularly our functional capabilities and scaling that up and out. I think I heard this morning that we have trained functionally, meaning people pretend like it's really happening, about 1,200 people so far at CDC, and more to come this November and more to come following that. So we take it very seriously, but we recognize that in our public health system, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And that just circles right back to the whole point of this conversation, is we need a health system that values health protection as much as it values disease care. And we're going to try to make that happen. Thank you very much.
Dr. Gerberding, thank you so much for being with us. The Atlanta Press Club would like to show our appreciation to you by making a donation to your favorite charity. We hope to see you all. How did I know that?
Skip.
At the CDC Foundation. Okay. We hope to see you all again at our next Newsmaker Luncheons. We will host Governor Sonny Perdue on November the 5th and John Huey, Editor-in-Chief of Time Incorporated, on November the 16th. We also look forward to seeing you at our holiday author party at New World of Coca-Cola on December the 5th. Don't forget, please, to become a member of the Press Club or to renew your membership. For more information on upcoming events and membership benefits, please visit our website at www.atlantapressclub.org. This concludes our program for today. Have a great day, and thank you for joining us.